Welcome to the After Podcast. I am Naveed Zamani, and I am typically your host. However, this month, I will be your guest, and your host will be the person who's usually behind the scenes of this podcast, Kern Howe, our audio engineer.
In this session, we discuss the challenges of the domestic violence field and the critical inclusion of family therapy as a road to healing in domestic violence. This month, I'm your host, Kern Howe. I do audio engineering for this podcast, as well as for other podcasts and music. And I've gotten a sense of AFTA and its members working on this podcast. So I'm looking forward to interviewing Naveed for this. So today's guest is Dr. Naveed Zamani. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in assisting Middle Eastern refugees navigating domestic violence. As a Persian American man in Southern California, he utilizes a decolonial post-structural feminism within a narrative therapy framework. Additionally, Dr. Zamani serves as a lecturer at San Diego State University and holds the position of head of research and training at Licensed Freedom, a nonprofit dedicated to aiding Middle Eastern refugees affected by domestic violence. So, in the way that you always start the podcast, Naveed, I'm going to ask you what's been capturing your attention these days.
Yes. Thank you, Kern. It's such an honor to be here with you. It's good that others can get to hear your voice and know all the work that you've put into this podcast. So thanks for all your efforts on all these podcasts.
Happy to be here.
So in regards to the work that's been capturing my attention these days, in addition to all the ways that all of our previous guests capture my attention in their work, I just completed some research for my doctoral dissertation regarding the intersection of couples counseling and domestic violence work, and the ways that couples counseling could, and I believe should, be utilized as a preventative effort to domestic violence, and the ways that, in my opinion, and some of the research I've done, there's been gaps in service and failures by broader systems in the United States to ensure that family therapy and relational work is a possibility in the domestic violence field and context. And just to be clear, when I say domestic violence field, I'm referring to the service providers and policies such as Violence Against Women's Act and other kind of the political service landscape of domestic violence and its attempts to help people who are encountering this thing called domestic violence.
When you say the political service landscape, what exactly does that entail in regards to this?
Yeah, that's an important distinction, that there's this highly complex relational thing called domestic violence that we are able to point to and speak to due to a history here in the United States of feminist writers, activists, practitioners, all the above, through blood and sweat and tears of, like, really through the 20th century, impressing the idea of violence against women and violence within intimate partnerships as a critical problem to be addressed as a society. So this was like this big grassroots movement that happened in the 20th century. And then when you see the Reagan administration in the 80s come into play, you see a huge shift away from these grassroots organizations, from kind of domestic violence within activist spheres, to services being provided primarily through law enforcement and judicial systems like the courts. And part of what those systems have done and continue to do today is, it's complex. On one hand, it's to be celebrated, right? Because prior to this, it was very challenging for particularly women to get access to just or fair court proceedings or lawyers or judges or even therapists that could really understand the politics of domestic violence, like within gender, within economic challenges, within marginalized communities. So it was celebrated first, like, okay, like there's societal recognition of this problem. But as part of a larger political movement that the Reagan administration was undergoing, the services all centrally moved into law enforcement and the judicial systems, and all agencies and all providers kind of had to step into line with what these systems were requiring or kind of prescribing as a way to help communities. The problem there being that domestic violence stopped being understood as a family issue and moved into the notion of criminality.
Yeah, you would think it's like a like institutional recognition and acceptance as a victory, but then it seems like the institution kind of distorts
right
the way of dealing with it.
Yeah, I think an example I typically use to illustrate that is in the late 70s, rolled around mandated arrest policies for domestic violence calls for law enforcement. So this kind of followed an incident where what was historically happening, where there would be a call for domestic violence, which are typically in the United States very dangerous calls, especially because we're an indiscriminately armed nation and domestic violence calls are very just high conflict, high level energy situations. So having an armed police officer show up can be critical as a measure of safety for certain communities. So it's important to name this, right? Like just certain communities in which this would be helpful. Other communities, an armed police officer showing up is hugely dangerous or scary. And so to circle back, there was a famous case where a woman calls the police. The police shows up. They walk the husband around the block, basically, and tell him to cool it, which, to my understanding at the time, was kind of a standard practice or approach. The guy returns to the home and then murders his partner. And so then after that, the family sued. And I think it was Torrington was the case. And the family sued. And then these policies came forward where now there has to be one arrest. One person needs to be removed from the home at minimum or arrested, depending on what the police officer interprets. So what that does is, whenever there's a domestic violence call, they show up, the police assess and interpret who is at fault here, and they remove that person. So this was celebrated as a victory at the time by feminists. But again, we're talking about like suburban white women, or like suburban, not suburban, but like middle-class white women who are feeling the effects of this inclusion.
Yeah.
Communities of color are still not feeling totally safe.
I know a lot of your work, from what I understand, focuses on how this type of implementation is different across cultures, like an intersectionality of dealing with this. And how that kind of thing can be a victory for one group, but make it actually like quite a bit harder.
Right.
For other groups.
Yeah. So to kind of bring into focus, sharper focus, the Middle Eastern community. So here in San Diego, we have a huge refugee community. And in our East County region, we have a massive Middle Eastern population, like huge. I think the second largest Chaldean Iraqi population, and Chaldeans are Christian Iraqis. I think the first one's in Michigan, the biggest population. So that's just one example. We have this huge influx of Iraqis. We have a lot of Afghans now following the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. And if you can imagine in these contexts, you have a Middle Eastern family who's brought in by, this is a refugee family. They're brought in by IRC, or International Rescue Committee. They're placed in a home. They're given cash or cash aid for a couple months, 3 months, 6 months. That starts to dry up before they're able to get their permitting to work. And before they're like kind of learned English and able to like kind of enter the workforce in a way that's sustainable and gives them access to financial resources. So now imagine you have this Middle Eastern family. Let's say they're Syrian. Male, female couple. And let's say they have five children. I'm kind of drawing on a couple families and kind of
from your work at License
to
Freedom.
Correct. They show up they're met with severe economic challenges. And part of their training when they come in is that the law enforcement agencies down here in San Diego, as well as the DA's office, will engage in these kind of like training, the district attorney, in these training processes where they kind of like meet these refugees and they say, hey, welcome to the United States. By the way, this is a free country, and this is a country of freedom and equality. We don't have gender trouble, as you can imagine. So if you have trouble with your partner or your husband, call 911. We have services to come out and support you. Cool. So that's kind of plants a seed. They're met with financial challenges. They live in these paper-thin apartments, the walls are paper-thin. And if anyone has ever heard, like, Arabic speakers, like, if we're talking about the zone of interpretation between languages, to English ears, the Arabic language is hard to discern tone or emotion. It sounds harsh to English ears. It's kind of like how we might hear German at times, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. That was the first thing I thought of.
That's a stereotype, I suppose, yeah. I don't speak German, so I want to be careful. But again, it just, to our ears, sounds harsh. So you have this refugee family in this apartment. They get into a heated argument. And then you have your neighbors who hear like these scary Arabs yelling at each other. And, you know, you have this, the last 30 years of American propaganda about who Middle Easterns are and who Muslims are and all this stuff, you know. And so you do the thing a good neighbor would do. You pick up the phone, you call 911, or the partner themselves, at the recommendation of the DA and other trainings, calls 911. And then the police department shows up. The police show up. And the police departments out there are largely comprised of Iraq War veterans. And so now you have the folks who went in with military training into these countries now policing the communities that they invaded and using the same methods of interpretation to discern what happened in this event. And they walk in, they see a bearded Middle Eastern guy, and they see a Middle Eastern woman in a hijab, and it's just clear who the offender is. And it's very clear that the domestic violence occurred. So then they remove the man. They bring an advocate, if she's lucky, to explain what's going on. CPS now gets involved because there was kids in the back room. And so this whole slew of services and bureaucratic power follows, right? Because now this woman is in the arms, claws, clutches, whatever kind of metaphor you want to use there, of these systems. So now she has CWS mandating her to go to parenting classes, to go to English classes. And very little is done to address the systemic issues affecting this family. Rent, food, mental health services, all those things are kind of considered adjacently to the primary thrust of getting this family into order and shape through psychoeducational processes. Yeah. So she's doing her thing. They take him to jail. So this is the truth. This is the story from one of my clients. This piece, this whole thing is different parts of people's stories.
Not hypothetical.
This is not hypothetical. Thank you. He's now in jail for 3 days because they can't find an interpreter for him. They finally bring in an interpreter, and this is a Syrian man. They bring in an interpreter who's an Egyptian Arabic speaker. And for any Arabic speakers, this might be evident already, but for the rest of you, Arabic is spoken across many, many countries, many, many ethnic groups, and is like pretty disparate in terms of its dialects. So an Egyptian, so imagine like, Kern, you go to Iraq with your partner, you get arrested for domestic violence, you get thrown into jail, and then an Irish guy comes in to interpret for you what the judge is saying and what's happening. You'd be kind of challenged and probably quite nervous about the critical things you're missing.
Yeah.
So he's in the courts now. He's getting 50% of what's happening because he's not fully understanding. And they say, go to the Middle East. Hey, by the way, we have a Middle Eastern group for you. Domestic violence intervention program, a rehabilitation program, 52-week program that you need to do. So he lands in front of me. And guess what? I'm Iranian. He's Syrian, or maybe there's some Iraqi men in the group. And for anyone familiar with the geopolitics and the history of the Middle East, just because we're Middle Eastern doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to be able to help each other, that we speak the same language, or that there's even like a relationship there that's helpful. For example, I've had many Iraqi clients say, like, your family killed my family because of the Iraq-Iran war. Sorry, yeah, you're going to say something.
And you're Iranian-American.
And I'm Iranian, right?
Distinguish it more. You're also American, as you pointed out. Like, to them, it's, you know, even more of a distance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. To them, I'm white, yeah. Right? I was educated here. I speak the language. I'm connected to the systems. I have so many privileges here as an American. Yeah. So I'm white, effectively.
Yeah. I've heard you talk about some of this, and it's an extremely tricky topic. And I guess the way you kind of described it, the political aspect of it, it's reminding me of from a few years ago where like the narrative and ideas around like defund the police were going around a lot. And what it was really about was more just like, in one interpretation, is like relieve the police of all these duties that have been foisted upon them, that are like social services that have like for some reason become police responsibilities. It's like they're there to like fight crime kind of thing. And then it's like, oh, but they're also there to deal with mental health. They're also there to deal with domestic violence. Like, you know, this kind of like everything has been under the umbrella of crime.
Right.
Yeah, I'm curious. I don't know if that like movement went too far, like from a few years ago, but like how much was there any like redistribution of funds, like towards like the programs you do?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So yeah, the defund the police movement was really important to me because I know it was challenging for a lot of people to engage with. And I think some of the challenge is that sometimes the conversation wasn't always grounded. Right? Like we'd be in these like grand conversations about what it means, like what, we're just going to have crime. Like that was like some of the conclusions people would come to. So to be specific to my work. Yeah, exactly. Defund the police. And for me, part of my research is like, as an effort to reconsider domestic violence as only a criminal act that needs to necessarily be treated through criminality, right? Like through the judicial system. I think couples counselors and family therapists can play a huge role. And one of the things I found in my research, I was interviewing, it was a qualitative study. I interviewed 9 marriage and family therapists here in California. One of the big things that I found unanimously across all participants was that they all were trained in their couples counseling class that when domestic violence is present, you refer them out. You don't do the couples counseling work. This is inaccurate. When you go into the literature, there's nowhere that it says that it's illegal to do that work. It's just very clear that this is very challenging, potentially very dangerous work, requires a lot of ethical consideration, and requires special training, which
and
is
liability.
True. Yeah, it's a huge liability, but that part I agree with. But what had happened was the AMFT, American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, on their website, they indicate that when there is domestic violence, it's contraindicated to work with those couples because domestic violence is a criminal act. And then when you go to the Department of Justice website, they say that couples counseling is contraindicated due to marriage and family therapy research. But marriage and family therapy research doesn't indicate that. It's just these two orgs, powerful institutions, pointing at each other, saying the other says don't do it. And, you know, the conspiracy side of me believes that that is pretty helpful to our larger U.S. system. It supports greater police funding. It supports greater, like, funding for the judicial systems I was talking about. It allows all the people that are making fun, and this is back to the very original question you asked me, when I refer to the field, I'm referring to people like myself included, who are making money off of the existence of domestic violence, and there's very little effort to stop it. And the preventative stuff, in my opinion, that is put forward and I'm using quotes for those listening. The preventative stuff is like, let's go into schools and talk about teen relationship dating violence. Let's go to different communities and show them the power control wheel. I don't think there's a problem with that stuff. But I think when that stuff is divorced from larger societal needs, right? Like for politicians to say, I'm against domestic violence, and in the same breath, vote against women's reproductive rights or cut all social service safety nets. I mean, women, you look at the research, and the research is very individualized and neoliberal in saying, it takes a woman 7 times to decide to leave. Well, when a woman is choosing between homelessness and a system in a world that's hugely abusive and scary, and she has kids, let's say, to a partner that's abusive, but at least she knows and can predict, and in some ways has less power than CWS or law enforcement or drug addiction or whatever, you know, homelessness carries with it. Yeah, it makes sense that people are not leaving or are, quote unquote, choosing to stay with the abuser. And I'm quoting that language again because the field fails to hold themselves accountable. We demand accountability for our clients, but it's very hard for us to look at ourselves and be accountable.
Yeah, it's a really, I don't know, it's interesting. It's like a particularly challenging topic. Just that it has so many prickly things kind of like off the bat to that people will kind of have their own feelings about, like even just, I mean, violence, violence that's especially against women. Just the idea of like defunding the police as a topic, like immediately tricky. I mean, in your research, I don't know, were there any challenges you ran into in kind of like digging into these topics, or are you kind of just interviewing people who are already kind of on your page, or what's it been like discussing these ideas kind of like a little bit broader?
Yeah,
perhaps.
I like the word prickly because there are a lot of prickly little pieces there, right? For example, for me to be a cisgendered heterosexual man, Middle Eastern man, I'm going to use that language, with a beard, and to talk about domestic violence and to start to critique or wonder about some of it, I think puts people on edge as a starting place. So I need to constantly situate myself and also be held. I'm interested in being held accountable, right? So that's part of the feminist ethic I put forward is like, yeah, I want to be held accountable to my ideas. And there are necessarily important questions to be raised. And one of the things I've, for example, confronted is in my trainings here in San Diego, lawyers get quite frustrated with what I'm saying because it's kind of questioning the primary method in which you're going about and treating domestic violence, which is through the legal context. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not here to like raise philosophical existential questions about the necessity of laws and all that. I am questioning the centrality of it and that's the primary flow. And for folks to get services through nonprofit agencies, often you need a police report or some sort of restraining order or some like these prescriptions that rely on, assume that people are comfortable and okay with these systems and that these systems work. So yeah, there's a lot of pushback from the people in the field themselves. I think another challenging piece in the world of academia is that it's really hard to talk about, for me, I guess, to talk about domestic violence without kind of an activist spirit. Because the world of domestic violence is shaped by activism. I believe it continues to be propelled by activism. And therefore, the critiques are necessarily, for me, feel activist-y, for lack of a better term. But it's hard to do that when the field is crawling with psychologists and lawyers and cops who want a different type of talk. They want a more objective, modernist, kind of positivist way of describing the work, which I think is, I think data is pretty important. Yeah, so I'm not questioning that piece. But I've had to like learn how to talk to different communities with the right tone and with the right approach.
And I imagine there's a degree of, well, it sounds like what you're looking for is something that kind of works, something that, it sounds funny, but something that works. Like, what is actually effective care versus, like, pointing a finger and saying, hey, what you are doing is wrong, stop doing it.
Yes.
Like, that isn't necessarily effective, and you're seeking something that kind of more holistically addresses a problem. I mean, how, what metrics, I guess, do you use to determine, like, hey, this type of care is effective, or how does this?
It's such a good question, because it's so hard to develop metrics in the domestic violence world, because the participants, the people, are elusive. And typically, domestic violence is also sometimes a transient experience, so it's hard to capture people in those moments. So the research part is challenging. Now, in terms of, like, research or data that's out there that can be used to, like, kind of signal stuff, one of the challenges is that we have, the domestic violence field has not shifted its approach since the 80s, and inadvertently has stymied a lot of important research to consider alternative options. What that's developed, what that looks like in the discourse in the DV field, in my experience, is that people saying, like, yeah, this is all that works, pointing to what we have. No research shows that anything else works. Well, there's not a lot of opportunity. So that was, like, where I started. I was like, ah, there's not much else that shows that it works. Actually, there's a lot of research that indicates that, or that has potential. For example, just to point to one, because there's a lot. Dr. Sandra Stith, out of, I believe it's Kansas State University, has developed incredible models to work with couples in high conflict and in violence. That has pretty strong, from what I can tell, reliability and validity. The research is robust. It's been tested. And there's a really nice structure in how to proceed with this practice in a way that it keeps safety central, right? Because one, kind of going back to the prickly thing, one of the challenges in the DV field is that, like, you have disparate voices arguing with each other within the field. You have psychologists who tend to, like, individualize and diagnose. And this is where a lot of the language of narcissism in the field comes from, right? Like, it's these, like, personality types and their intersection that creates these challenges. You have feminist voices, which, again, feminism is a broad category, but just for the sake of conversation, like, kind of naming some of the social conditions, especially as it's related to gender, as kind of like the fertile ground in which domestic violence occurs, right? You have family therapists, who I personally want to be a bigger part of the conversation. You have lawyers and law enforcement and social workers. And so all these stakeholders have different perspectives on what the solution to domestic violence is. From my corridor, what I want to do is say to the family therapy world, like, we need family therapists in this work. And domestic violence work is so highly individualized and criminalized right now that I believe just suggesting to do family work is radical. And it shouldn't be, but it sadly is, I think, in the DV world, because, yeah, it's filled with liability and fear and nervousness. And that was one of the things that my research indicated, was like, therapists are with a lot of fear. And in some ways, this is my extrapolation, I believe it's connected to some insecurity from the training processes to engage with these families when things come up. And so they refer out. But then we're referring out people to where? To law enforcement? To social workers, often to community agencies that are run by MFT trainees or other, like, pre-licensed folks. So it's, I don't know, like, there isn't a lot of consideration of, like, okay, I can't do this work. And then we refer them to these DV agencies. And the DV agencies, again, are connected to these systems that I'm lovingly critiquing.
Is that such as, I know you used to be a part of the domestic violence response team.
Yeah. Well, and then there's that. Thank you for bringing that up. The domestic violence response team, I was going out with law enforcement on calls. So that tends to be our response, is like, wait till it's bad enough. But if a couple comes in and they both are like, there's violence starting to occur, we both don't want it to happen, they're often met with therapists who just, or put their hands up and say, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. Or I recommend you go to this community agency, and the community agency says, do you have a police report? Do you have a restraining order? No? Okay, well, we can't do the work because it's too, there's too much liability. And so then people are left to fend for themselves, or they find themselves in religious contexts who could perpetrate the patriarchal forces that are feeding into the domestic violence. I don't know. Or people, that's its own research probably, but.
That reminds me of, I think that was an important element of that book from a number of years back, Conflict Is Not Abuse, where the author talks about by seeing all conflict as abuse, it creates this thing where a certain threshold has to be met for services to be given. And so it encourages people to see, like, label, like, escalate conflict to the point that they'll meet a threshold for services versus kind of like deal with it before it's, you know, at the level of like needing like law enforcement to step in.
I mean, as like an adjacent issue, if we're even like here, if I'm talking about clients, right, like my therapy clients, and I start to use kind of a neoliberal language of commerce and capitalism and some of that stuff, then my clients, my customers, would be fools to use more nuanced, neutral language because you want the service. So as a customer talking to a customer service rep, right, in the United States, if you want something from the customer service rep, it's to your advantage to exaggerate a little bit so they get them to respond. Now, I'm not saying people are coming to DV services exaggerating. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying like there's a lot of different cultural forces, and I'm just plucking on one, to your point, that makes the languaging of domestic violence challenging. It makes it a little bit binaried. I think the inclusion of the legal field forces a binary onto people. And the example being like kids don't see a plaintiff and a defendant. They see mom and dad. And then the therapist comes in following legal, like, you know, they get a report from the courts. And then the family therapist is sitting there saying, well, I'm really afraid of dad. I'm like, have you talked to dad? And they're like, no, I'm really afraid of him. And like, I'm not saying people shouldn't be afraid of people who are violent, but as family therapists, like, how do we start to think about assessments? How do we think about assessments within the context of a family when it's related to domestic violence? How do we get in voices and perspectives as part of a relational healing journey? All that stuff just feels really stymied and like not possible in the contemporary landscape of domestic violence services. It's really like sketchy to do that.
And it's work, like to make the decision to go in and do, you know, couples therapy or family therapy is hard work.
And
it's tough to find time.
Our society doesn't pay you extra for that. Yeah. Like I have a colleague who does primarily family therapy because she's so damn good at it and she loves it. And she's telling me, yeah, insurance doesn't pay anything extra for that. Like they actually don't want me to do it because they don't want me to get a sense that I deserve more.
Wow.
So like there's not really any systems that support family therapy. But and I'll just say this as a quick plug. This is why I'm a member of AFTA, because I'm just like, I need to be around people committed to family therapy. And AFTA is one of those communities for me.
Also, now that I think about it, there are so many movies that the plot is about complex family dynamics and basically like how much this family would benefit, or like the individuals in the family would benefit from family therapy being a thing. And even I feel like I can't think of a specific example of this one thing, but where like one member of the family goes to therapy and it like bothers the other members because they're like, you're only telling your portion of the story. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, wouldn't it be great if we could all like partake in this? And yeah, it's really, I mean, it's pretty different from like my general understanding of kind of American attitudes towards family versus like a lot of other attitudes towards family in the rest of the world. I'm sure that's a pretty big situation in the work you do, is like just different family attitudes.
Yeah. And if you start to think about the broader culture, the effects within that culture, down to the family culture, down to the individual spirit, like it's a lot to track. It's complex. I heard this really hilarious quote that said, the most selfish person you know is in therapy being told that they need to take time for themselves and they need to be more selfish sometimes to take care of themselves, right? And I think that's the threat of individualized therapy, is like you're just devoid of the broader context you're in. It's hard to hold people accountable. And again, this word accountable is such a, every time I say it in talking about DV, I have to like pause and just clarify, because I think in our language, especially in the DV field, accountability is very closely nestled to the word punishment. And I'm kind of thinking of accountability as just taking account of another person's story. Like, can you account for the other person's experience or the other person's story? And I think if we're so centrally focused on accountability in domestic violence, then logically, in my opinion, we should get multiple perspectives and family voices in the process. Now, I would be remiss to not mention that, like, my dissertation, I don't want to, I'm not interested in just floating in critiques. Kind of easy to do in some ways. So my dissertation concluded in I call it the down and forward approach, a model to do couples counseling and family therapy with Middle Eastern refugee families who need interpretation, as kind of a response to some of the findings in my research and the problems, my identified problems with the field. And the down and forward language comes from a response to the domestic violence epistemology pretty consistently inviting people to look upwards at power in kind of the meta sections of society, up and back and into histories that we hold. So we're kind of like constantly going through like what happened and how is it connected to larger political movements, which again isn't, I'm not saying we shouldn't do, but for the family therapy work, I'm like, how do you look down at what's happening in the family rather than creating a priori conceptualizations of domestic violence, right? Like, oh, here's the power control wheel and here's the cycle of violence and this is how your relationship fits this model. Rather, what's happening with the family? How do you as a therapist and the family in within the context create the language and an understanding of the dynamics that contribute to violence, and then what are the implications for moving forward? And in that practice is like, I think, revolutionary love, where sometimes as we're hearing people's stories with compassion and love, interest in their context, but not an interest in excusing them despite the context. So that's some of the accountability piece. I think we can craft relational pathways that could be radical, could be useful. And sometimes, like with some of the men I work with, the conclusion is that love in this situation means that you're staying away from your family. Like, it doesn't always mean that people are coming back together happy, right? Like, it's not like an American movie where everyone needs to necessarily red ribbon bow it at the end and it's all happy. Like, a lot of harm happened here. Your family doesn't trust you. And actually, like, there's some acts of violence that you continue to be in that are risky. And so perhaps reparations to your family or community or to your relationship means you staying away.
Yeah, that's, wow, that's...
So it's not, there's no prescription that you land at, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And this is the thing I want to move away from, is a prescription piece. This is my post-structural piece, where I'm like, how do we get away from prescriptions? Because, like, for example, CWS comes into these refugee families, like these Afghan families, and says, you need a restraining order. And they're in constant violations of restraining orders, because this restraining order doesn't account for cousins being married. And then the cousins, because in the African communities that we work with, it's pretty, right? It's not uncommon for the husband and wife to be cousins. So,
I didn't know that.
First or second cousins. And so then you have mom and dad. You have the in-laws in Kabul talking to each other, trying to like go through their own cultural process of fixing this marriage or supporting this relationship that's now on the other side of the world. And they're contacting each other. And so then the identified victim says, yeah, my father-in-law keeps calling me and trying to encourage me to get back with him. And they're like, well, that's a violation of the restraining order. But also it's not, because it's international, so we can't really do much about it. So the prescriptions don't, they're too simplistic to rely on legal, U.S. legal stuff, and are not that useful. Now, you know, and I'm probably going too far with this conversation at this point, but part of my down and forward approach suggestions include training, because to do the work, you need to be pretty highly trained, I believe. And if you can imagine,
as a family therapist,
Yeah. Because if you're going to not do prescriptions and not engage in like routine and rote steps of practice, then you got to be highly improvised. Right, like I use a jazz metaphor throughout my down and forward approach, and I'm smiling saying this to you, Kern, because you're a jazz musician. Well, I don't know if you identify that way, but I've seen you play some good jazz. You have to be practiced. You have to be intentional. You need to be in a community of other jazz musicians. You need to be able to improvise, and you need to also be very clear on where everyone else in the group is musically. Like, what is the key, the tempo, what are we doing here? And you're like responding in the moment to what's happening, but not just willy-nilly.
And one of the most important things in music is when you fall or trip up, which will happen, how do you recover from that? And how do your collaborators respond to your, like, you know, mistakes, so to speak, is like probably the biggest element of improvising from my experience, is like acknowledging that there will be like mistakes, slip ups, etc., and like the response to that is like kind of the most important element.
Yes.
And like speaks to the quality of the working together.
Right. And that's why in the approach, the first like six sessions are dedicated to the structures of therapy, so that when the mistakes occur, because it's, this work is high stakes. Right, like a mistake on stage is sonic and transient. A mistake in domestic violence couples counseling could be lethal.
Yeah.
And so what are the structures in place to ensure, to stay, keep everyone closely connected to safety as you're moving along? And I don't think that that's should be left up to improv. That's structure. That requires like clinical structure and intentionality in how you're moving forward.
Yeah, it's I mean, does any of the research you did for your dissertation, like, does that lead to further research that you're involved in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I, you know, speaking to my imagined AFTA community here, who a lot of them are PhDs, are going to just chuckle at the simplicity of this statement, but just... the further I dug into the research, the more I learned that I could go my whole life studying this, and I will have barely scratched the surface of the knowledge base. So yeah, the opportunity for research is incredibly huge. And there's several things that I'm kind of committed to right now in terms of like developing the practices, getting some video for those trainings to kind of like demonstrate the work itself, because it's hard to like just talk about Western music theory without having ever heard it, right? Or like I could describe to you Hindustani music theory, well, not well, because I don't really understand it that well. I could try to. At the end of the day, you're gonna want to hear it. So there's ways that I'm invested in that portion for the training. And then also like, what does it mean for a post-structuralist therapist who's context-driven, ideally, to what does a training for that type of therapist look like? Right? Like, how do you train a jazz musician is like the parallel process I'm looking at. Because it's hard to start people in jazz.
Like, arguably, by putting it in the institution, some people say it was over. That was the end of it. Once it started being trained, it was... you know, became something else.
Right. No, it's good. There's limitations to the metaphor for sure. But yeah, I mean, maybe you're right though. I mean, I don't know if family therapy is happening. The most radical family therapy is happening in universities. I don't know. But I want family therapy to be more central.
And as my outsider, non-therapist position, just a listener, and I like learning. A lot of what you're describing sounds like things that are really enabled by kind of more of a social safety network to an extent. Like, it's like a lot of this seems like the busier and more kind of strapped for cash and time people are, the harder it is to put your time and money towards like your own health and your family's health.
Right.
And these are things that, do exist like in parts of the world. So it's nice to know that it's kind of possible for these things. I knew someone, there was this couple of artists who were like in their 30s and they were like, oh, we're never going to have kids. We live in New York. Life's too hard. And then they moved to Holland or something, the Netherlands. And they were like, oh, we're losing money if we don't have kids because education's free, daycare's free, healthcare's free. Like, these are all these social, like, we're paying taxes for this. We might as well. Now they have like three kids. And it was just interesting to think that a move from, you know, rise and grind New York City to the Netherlands inspired them to go from like being like, no, we're not kid people to, oh, I guess we have three kids now.
Yeah. I think one of the most powerful things that the conservative movement in the United States did was to co-opt the family values language.
Yeah.
Because when people bring up family values, everyone rightfully shudders because you know you're about to get hit with some weird stuff, to say the least.
Yeah.
But, dude, I think domestic violence is a matter of family values. Like, what do we stand for? And what does it mean to be in a family and, like, talk about or think about nonviolence? And how do you parents, how do you confront violence with nonviolence? And I don't know. Questions I'm asking myself right now is I have a 5-year-old daughter and a 5-week-old son. Like, what are these things I'm thinking about and talking about mean in my daily practice with my kids?
No, it's big stuff and it's like hard work. I'm like just glad, I'm glad someone's doing it.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'll say this as we're like wrapping up that, like, I don't think everyone can or should do it. It takes a specific type of work. My ability for the work is steeped in my life privileges. I never saw domestic violence in my family. I'm lucky to say that. So when I'm working with families in domestic violence, my head's not going to my own world. And like, as I, and this is one of the big things that my research indicated was like people's threshold for when to refer out, as they interpreted their couples, the couples that they were working with, their level of conflict, like their interpretation of when the conflict was actually abuse or not was dependent on their own family history. So folks who were in a family with high levels of conflict that never went to violence were much more willing to work with couples than folks who were in family contexts where low levels of conflict, again, these are relative terms, led to violence, because the idea was like, there's a lot of risk here and opening up any conversation could lead to violence and my license is on the line, and et cetera, et cetera.
That seems like a pretty good metric for kind of like finding people to be part of things, like as services grow and stuff like that, that would be like a good filter.
And MFT trainings are doing this work. I'm sorry, MFT like programs generally are required to do this work of having MFTs confront their biases and stuff like that. But I do think we could be a little bit more intentional and targeted and be specific to say couples counseling is possible if there's violence. It just requires a lot more assessment. And if you're going to refer out, you need to be intentional with who and where and how you refer out. That like, as you're confronting your biases, part of it should be connected to considerations of like, what kind of work can you or do you want to do? Because perhaps you are interested in couples counseling, and as much as you're like invested in supporting domestic violence, it brings up a lot of your own family history and it's just too much. And so you, I respect that. I respect that kind of self-knowledge.
Well, Naveed, thank you for
thank you,
being
Karen.
A guest on the show today. Is there any work or anything you want to, you know, plug that you've been, that you've got?
I try to keep my website up to date, NaveedZamani.com, very original website. And I am actively publishing, so I invite people to take a look at some of my work if they want, but I'm currently in some writings around with some of what I just described. But my dissertation that I was talking about today here is available on the Taos Institute website. And yeah, thank you, Kern, so much for hosting me and all the work you've done on the back end of this website. I'm sorry, of this podcast. It's meaningful to me to have you be host.
Yeah, thanks for being willing to get on the other side of it.
Thank you.